The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, if our old goons are retiring and the new goons are arriving, who's going to train them? We're not doing it the old-fashioned way, are we?
Well, we might. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the old way.
That would require one or both of us to travel up into the very highest attic rooms of the library, madam. I believe you know this.
Oh, gosh, it is so spooky up there, Mr. Darling. Perhaps there is another way.
Perhaps indeed, madam.
Oh, what a damp and foggy night for you all to come out. Please come through and warm yourselves by the fire as soon as you can. Mr. McCoy! Your hair has gone all curly in the drizzle. I'll have a maid fetch you a towel. Please don't concern yourself with the runes embroidered on it. They'll have no effect on your lovely locks. That's all I can promise you. Let me dispense with the announcements as you file in. The odor doesn't always matter, does it? Well, hard cheese. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I am your humble host, Miranda Merrick. We have just a few minor things to clear up before we begin our tale of terrible maritime woe. First, you may have overheard a word or two of Mr. Darling and myself playfully discussing, joking about goons. This is just a little in-house, out-of-date, old term that used to be bandied about by my grandmothers back when we were having more prominent trouble with the townspeople directly threatening the library. Back when there were way more of them than there were of us, so to speak. Whatever that means. But in the past few years, we've been able to even the score just a bit better. And, we sometimes still say goons as a term of endearment. You'll just have to trust us on this. You'll just have to. So, these goons are people that we know and love. And they, help the library. They protect the library, and they mix right in amongst you, and always have. And, you just shouldn't worry about it. Just think of them as really strong maids. Yes, that is the perfect way to think of them. And, let's move on to other things. Excuse me. Now, the other note is that the historic Wilson estate that we recently acquired with the help of all of your kind signatures on the annex forms, it has been decided that the estate is to go to the League of Lady Gravediggers. And is to be turned into a bed and breakfast. What a wonderful little sideline adventure for that handy group. all that private property for the girls to do, whatever they like. Good for them, I say. Many of you will take them up on a chance for a cozy getaway, no doubt. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about their plans as they, dig in. And now, my dear guests, as you choose your seats in the reading room, I'm compelled and disheartened to tell you that our story this evening is one of utter doom. As a courtesy to you, I've asked our Natasha to set out our best black tea and ginger biscuits on the hospitality tray in an effort to give us all just a little something to be grateful for as we hear the harrowing historical account of so many who lost everything. This reading will be given a very different tone, and by this I mean one that imparts a deep respect to those who were the unfortunate victims of this inhumane circumstance. I do caution you that this story is heartbreakingly bleak, but I can tell you that as we near the end, there is a portion of the story that will restore your hope and inspire you. I promise. It seems best to bear in mind that these tragic events happened long ago, but not so long ago that we cannot learn the very valid lessons that they can teach us about how we treat one another in the world today. Well, my lovelies, let us not be late for our doomed voyage. In September of 1845, a strange disease affected the potato crops all across the fields of Ireland. This was the very beginning of what was called the potato blight, which meant that at harvest time, between a third and half of the entire nation's crop was black with rot. Blighted potatoes cannot be eaten. To put it plainly, they are no longer food. The microfungus lands upon the tender leaves, then travels inside of the veins of the plant, down under the ground, into the developing tuber, insidiously replacing the nutrients of the food with stinking brown sludge. The potato was the staple food of Ireland, and it had doubled in price over the winter of that year. Times were dire. The people were famished, but most hadn't reached the point of starvation. No one knew for certain back then what had caused the blight, where it came from, or how it was spread. They hoped that the cold winter had killed off whatever it was and vowed to plant heartily in the spring and begin anew. It was the only way they ever knew to just start over. After all, the humble potato was the one thing that would grow well in the harsh Irish soil. It didn't work out. The emaciated farmers worked hard planting even more potatoes in the spring, and the blight returned in a more powerful form and shriveled the potatoes as they formed in the soil. It was said that you could smell the acres and acres of fields rotting for miles around across Ireland. The entire country's main food source was gone. Nothing remained except dry, blackened stalks. The Prime Minister at the time, a man ironically named Peel, directed two different commissions, one to investigate the cause of the blight, and one to explore options for the preservation of good potatoes for consumption, and neither were fruitful. Before long, the first reports of starvations began coming in 1846. In lieu of aid that would go directly to the farmers, Parliament raised taxes on landowners where all the farmers lived. And this tax money was going to be used to build workhouses for the now destitute farmers who were currently starving to death. And I think we can all see the glaring oversight here. As you might imagine, the wealthy landowners became concerned that this level of taxation could increase and even continue for years into the future, especially since no one knew what the blight was, what caused it, or how to stop it. And after doing some quick calculations, they discovered it would be far cheaper to pay to transport each individual person, or even entire families who were living on their land, all the way across the Atlantic to North America, being the United States and Canada. If their workers were gone off their property, they couldn't be taxed on them. They swiftly began making arrangements. Enter the coffin ship. This soon became the all too apropos name given to the vessels because of their downright awful living conditions, if we can even call them that. It's estimated that 5,000 masted ships carried the troubled men, women, and children from Ireland, Scotland, and England during the 1840s and 50s. Many of these people never arrived in North America. There once was a ship called the Hannah that set sail out of Ireland in 1849 on April 3rd with a crew of 12 and approximately 180 Irish farmers and their family members. I say approximately because the passenger list was lost. The ship's own Dr. Graham reported that their 23-year-old captain, Captain Shaw, was mistreating the unmarried young women in the night on the ship during their cold voyage. On the night of April 29th, in high winds, the ship struck a reef of ice, puncturing a hole in its side. The young captain stole the only lifeboat and fled in it with his first and second officers. The captain tried to have the passengers sealed up in the hatch of the ship by having it nailed shut before he abandoned them, but they broke through. As the ship sank in darkness, the terrified passengers scurried and flung themselves onto an ice floe. All manner of horrors happened as children and adults fell into the icy water. People were tangled in the ropes and debris and in the slushy waters. Some went down with the ship. Some drifted away as the ice broke up. When dawn came, a passing ship was able to save many who had huddled together and somehow lived through the awful night. It is believed in all, 49 died for certain. And for a coffin ship, this would be minimal. In April of 1847, which was also referred to as Black 47, there was a member of Parliament and an immigrant advocate named Stephen de Vere, who voluntarily traveled to Quebec to observe the typical conditions on board one of the ships. This is a quote from his observations. Hundreds of poor people, men, women, and children of all ages, from the dribbling idiot of 90 to the babe just born, huddled together without light, without air, wallowing in filth, and breathing a fetid atmosphere, sick in body, dispirited in the heart. The number given is 1.5 million, but probably more than 1.5 million souls were uprooted from their homelands and herded onto tall-masted ships as though they were livestock. This is what happened to the poor people who were affected by the Great Famine or the Potato Blight. The gentry, rather than pay to have workhouses built, which was a useless plan in the first place, hired shipping companies to clear their property of the people who had no rights or say-so in the matter. Tragically, some of the would-be passengers passed away just a day or so before the landowners secured their ticket for the voyage, which was probably for the best. The ships were filthy, dangerous, overcrowded, poorly maintained, mismanaged, poorly stocked, and slow. A single crossing of the Atlantic could take longer than 6 weeks. The Passengers Act of 1842 was supposedly in effect during this time to protect all those who traveled on board these ships. But according to personal diaries, ships' logs, and official records, these strict rules, which stipulated such things as how much space each single passenger should be given, that no passenger should ever have accommodations below the waterline, compulsory lifeboats should always be in place, well-stocked medical supplies were to be on board, although the presence of a doctor was not mandatory, and minimum provisions per person of 7 pounds of edible food per week plus 3 quarts of fresh water were never enforced at any time. Each ship's provisions and their quality began with one man, the captain. He then chose his crew and decided what standard of goods was going to be set on his ship. Some miserable captains apparently had no standards whatsoever. If any passengers were fortunate enough to even have any food to bring with them, it was immediately at risk of being stolen. Most of the food on board was in the form of pitiful rations handed out by the crew to barely keep the people alive. It was often spoiled. The water was dirty. Some captains were known to purchase soggy corn at reduced prices, or to restrict rations once at sea. Unbelievably, some ships provided no food at all, and most had scarcely any medical supplies stocked, and certainly the majority, of course, had no doctor on board. In fact, conditions in the belly of a typical ship for a typical passenger were beyond atrocious. Most of the passengers once inside the ship and below deck were only permitted above deck if and when the captain permitted it during the entire voyage. For those that had a heartless foul man for a captain, it wouldn't be uncommon for these poor souls to spend the majority of their journey in the darkness of the hazy, moldering swamp of the underbelly of the disgusting boat. Out of greed, the shipping companies would recommission old ships just to get some money out of them. So an 80-year-old decrepit ship with perhaps less than 40 berths or passenger bunks below would be hastily patched up and sent to be crammed with several hundred frail and forlorn immigrants and whatever they could carry in their arms. They generally had nothing except the clothes on their backs, having sold or traded anything they did have away for food for their families. Even more absurd, the ships arriving in the harbor to take the famine victims out to sea contained tons of American corn that could have fed them. The rickety rat-infested ship then left Ireland with several hundred of the gaunt passengers, but would arrive in North America with 30% less passengers, or sometimes much, much less. One ship departed Ireland with 200 passengers and arrived in North America with 7. As a young man, author Herman Melville served as a deckhand on an immigrant ship that sailed from Liverpool in 1849. He documented his time on board, writing about the putrid conditions below deck. "We had not been at sea 1 week when to hold your head down the hatchway was like holding it down a cesspool." The ships didn't immediately carry the caustic title of coffin ship, but there are several good reasons why this soon became the unshakable nickname. There are several berth designs and dimensions, but a typical wood berth or bed in an old maritime ship was about 6 feet in length and 2 feet wide to accommodate the average sailor and kit. The berths below deck were hung in several rows along the body of the ship, with maybe just enough room to sit upright between bunks, or maybe not. There were also wooden stalls and hammocks, and on board the coffin ships, some could be stuffed with as many as 1,200 steerage passengers, meaning these people were considered to be little more than ballast to keep the boat afloat. So these berths were often occupied by more than one person and said to have less room than a coffin. The overflow of people were often left to lie on heaps of rags and straw on the floor. I'm sorry to say, this gets far darker, but it will get light again. And there is a kind of hero at the end. Again, I promise. It is known that many of the malnourished people who boarded the ships that weren't gravely ill at the start of their voyage soon became so shortly thereafter. Rats, fleas, lice, smallpox, fevers, coughs, dysentery, and contagious cholera and typhus were rampant on the ships. Those who kept personal diaries often wrote that the air was wet and sour with the smell of sickness and death. Typhus fever spreads rapidly, is carried by fleas and other small insects, and cholera is a bacterial infection that invades the human intestinal tract and is so vile it depletes its victims of all of their bodily fluids and is a painful death. The people on the ships were riddled with it, young and old alike. It's sometimes called the Blue Death because the dehydrated, ill person turns an ashen blue as they die. It's awful, even today. Briefly, in spite of some captains attempting to quarantine some passengers suspected of having this disease or that at the beginning of a journey, it would have been nearly impossible to avoid coming into contact with what was referred to as the effluvium, or mist that hung in the stifling, rancid air below deck, and breathing it into your lungs. And holy God, some of the bunks that were stacked one over the other, maybe four or five bunks high. The bunks had only slats with straw strewn on them. So, whatever dripped down from the dozen or so sick folks from above. This brings us to another unbelievably sad point about the name Coffin Ship. If a ship was only a third or halfway through its journey, and a good portion of its fares were dying, and space was severely limited, and there wasn't any way to store the corpses for future land burial, well, those poor souls had to be buried at sea. So, the bodies of the dead were routinely tossed from the rear of the ships. So routinely, in fact, that sharks, schools of sharks, began following the boats, knowing they could be relied upon for steady meals. This wasn't some nightmarish secret that only the captain and the crew knew about. The terrified, sick, and dying people below deck knew about the sharks. I'll share with you a slightly abridged quote taken from a book written by Robert White, who was on board one of the coffin ships in 1847. The quote is one that White recalls hearing a fellow passenger speak aloud in grief on board the ship. "We thought we couldn't be worse off than we were. But now, to our sorrow, we know the difference. For sure, supposing we were dying of starvation, or if the sickness overtook us, we had the chance of a doctor, and he could do no good for our bodies. Sure, the priest could for our souls, and then we'd be buried with our own people in the old churchyard, with the green sod over us, instead of dying like rotten sheep thrown into a pit, and the minute the breath is out of our bodies, flung into the sea to be eaten up by them horrid sharks." They absolutely knew. From what I've read, not much justice was ever sought during these times. There wasn't an interest in questioning the treatment of anyone on board the ships. This is just the way that it was. It was the cost of doing business. Even the young Captain Shaw, who stole the lifeboat, talked his way out of any charges when he was cross-examined in the courtroom. I have for you some interesting logbook numbers from a few of the ships. The Larch set sail with 440 passengers and had 108 deaths. The Avon began with 552 on board. 236 of them passed away. The Virginius departed with 476 on board, with 267 deaths. Overall, it is believed that over 100,000 lives were lost in transit on the coffin ships. Some passengers arrived too ill to walk off the ships under their own power at the end of the journey and had to be carried. Some actually crawled down the gangways. No one received a hero's welcome. The truth is, these poor people were shunned by most and mistreated by many. Irish need not apply, and help wanted no Irish signs were posted everywhere. Thankfully, many churches and goodwill organizations welcomed and helped these poor people assimilate into society. Many passengers had to be quarantined upon arrival at their destinations because they were so very ill, and a great many of them did not survive, of course. Remarkably, there may have been as many as 8,000 babies born on board the dreaded ships during the long voyages. But of course, the true numbers for them and their mothers was much lower. There once was a ship called the Jeannie Johnston. She was professionally built for hauling cargo in 1847 in Canada. Her sturdy hull was designed for the transport of timber, tobacco, molasses, and tea. But from 1848 to 1855, she dutifully carried 2,500 weary famine victims from Ireland to North America in a series of 16 voyages under the caring hand of Captain James Attridge. And not a single passenger was lost. No one ever died. He purchased only quality food and clean water for his passengers. And there was always a doctor on board on every voyage. The Jeannie Johnston went back into cargo service in the years after the famine ended, and in 1858, its load of timber became waterlogged, and the ship sadly sank. Again, no lives were lost. In 2002, an exact replica of the beloved ship was masterfully completed, and anyone can board her for tours in Dublin Docklands. Because of Captain Attridge, the Jeannie Johnston was the one ship that couldn't be called a coffin ship. Thank you, my dear guests, for coming to hear tonight's unique, woe-begotten tale. It was supposed to be a bit lighter in fare, but then I had to choose between hexing you or breaking your heart, and I chose to break your heart because that can be done en masse, and because hexing you should be done on an individual basis. Because I care about you as individuals. I'm altruistic like that. I'm sorry. Please allow our handsome Mr. Darling to see you safely to the exits. and we'll welcome you back next time for a more normal reading. I promise. Good night, my dear, dear guests. Good night.
Madam, if we can find Stefan Strangeways and hire him and his goblins to train our goons, neither one of us will have to go upstairs. But who knows where he is?
I do. I know precisely where he is every second of every day.
Madam, how is that possible?
Once you have a witch's blood under your skin, darling, she always knows right where you are. And I put all of those tattoos in my blood on his back.
Madam, you said the tattoo of the library's phone number on the inside of my ear was there in case I was ever hit by an automobile.
I know. Good night, Mr. Darley.
Madam! Madam! Do we even have a phone?
The Midnight Library would like to thank everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. We are here because of our beautiful patrons who donate at patreon.com/midnightlibrary. That's where all the real fun happens. Find our weird presence on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And our even weirder merch at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.